This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural transformation. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Painter Georgia O'Keeffe's work became increasingly revolutionary at the same time that she began a highly erotic relationship with photographer Alfred Stieglitz. Gertrude Stein also experienced a great leap forward in her work, both in its experimentation and its sensuality, following her relationship with Alice B. Toklas. And for Edith Wharton, Emma Goldman, and Kate Chopin, periods of great creativity and daring in their lives and work all coincided with periods of sexual awakening. Could a profound connection between a woman's brain and her experience of her vagina affect her greater sense of creativity, even her consciousness? In her provocative and important new book, Vagina, A New Biography, best-selling author of The Beauty Myth, Naomi Wolf, argues that this connection is not only real and long overlooked, but that it is fundamental to a woman's sense of self. This book is a radical exploration of the vagina as a gateway to and a medium of female consciousness itself. Naomi Wolf is an American author and former political consultant. She has toured the world speaking to audiences of all walks of life about gender equality, social justice, and most recently, the defense of liberty in America and internationally. Her essays and writing have appeared in The New Republic, Esquire, Ms., The Washington Post, The Huffington Post, and The New York Times. With the publication of the 1991 best-selling book, The Beauty Myth, she became a leading spokesperson of what was called the third wave of the feminist movement. Hello, Naomi, and welcome to the Pathways program.
Hello, Paul. Thank you for having me.
Now, as I mentioned in the intro, you've been described as a third wave feminist. Can you describe for our audience what that means? What is a third wave?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure anyone has a very specific answer. To me, it was really mostly generational. I wrote The Beauty Myth at a time of great, what Susan Faludi called backlash against women and the women's movement. The media was insisting that feminism was dead, it was over. As a student of cultural history, I knew that every time women make a big leap forward, there's quickly a movement in the media at the time to say that feminism is dead. So I just declared that there was a third wave of young women who were ready to go. I coined the phrase because that's a way of making something happen, but it was happening already. Labels are helpful. And other people like Rebecca Walker were coining the phrase at the same time. But so to me, it's generational. The second wave was the great wave in the 70s of Sheer Height and Judy Chicago and the Boston Women's Health Collective and Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem. But it's also a little bit stylistic. Some of the things third wave feminism pushed back against was the older generations. We thought a sort of Puritan approach to sexuality, among other things.
Right. Now, the impetus for this book, The Vagina, was a crisis in your own sex life.
I wouldn't put it that way.
But something happened to you.
It was definitely a medical crisis. And it, you know, it's a story that it's certainly very personal, but it's pretty necessary to bear an eyewitness account to it because it led me to do the research in the book about this extraordinary new 15 years of neuroscience that's not widely reported that has documented amazing new things about female arousal and orgasm and the relationship between women's sexuality and the brain, which you mentioned in your introduction. But I had a first-hand experience of this. I had a spinal injury, which I was not aware of. I was born with a variant of spina bifida, which I never knew about. But the spinal injury was causing a loss of sexual sensation. And it was also at the same time causing me to lose states of mind that I was used to experiencing after lovemaking. And these were positive states of mind. So I knew something was wrong. And it was really what scientists would call anhedonia, a sense that there wasn't joy and meaning in the world. It was dramatic. And then when I was treated for the spinal injury, thankfully, which involved surgery, my sexual sensation returned, thank God, but also so did these states of mind that I had not wanted to face the rest of my life without. Feeling energetic, focused, confident, risk-taking, feeling like I saw connections between things, like the light came back into the world. And so this was very dramatic, and I knew that something had happened, but I didn't know what. Of course, being a curious person, I started to interview my doctors, and I started to read up on the science, and it turns out that what happened to me was very straightforward, just people are not aware of it. The brain and the vagina are a single system connected through through the spine, and what the latest neuroscience points out is that when a woman is supported by her culture, supported by the people around her, most of all by herself, in knowing about her sexual response, anticipating positive sexual pleasure, it boosts dopamine in her brain, which was key to what happened to me. And dopamine is an amazing neurotransmitter politically. I call it the ultimate feminist neurotransmitter. It goes to focus, motivation, risk-taking, assertiveness, confidence, the sense of drive, the sense of trust in your own judgment. When a woman has an orgasm, it boosts opioids, which is that ecstasy transcendence. When she has an orgasm, also it boosts oxytocin, which is about, again, connection and trust. And so when I understood the neuroscience of this part of the brain-vagina connection, there are many, many other amazing discoveries that I report on. I didn't just understand what had happened to me, but I also understood something that had puzzled me for my entire career as a feminist, which is why for 5,000 years, in culture after culture, has the vagina and female sexuality and female knowledge about their own pleasure been targeted, mocked, derided, suppressed, in some countries mutilated, penalized, women kept in ignorance, because it turns out that actually neurochemically, pleasure makes women harder to subordinate. Politically, pleasure makes women harder to control.
But there's exceptions to that you point out in your book, like the Taoist cultures and some parts of the world where they actually had a lot of reverence for the vagina.
Absolutely right. And I did look at the Han Dynasty with the Taoist culture you just mentioned, and also at Tantra, which came out of India many centuries ago. And it was really a dramatic, you know, difference from the Western culture, which we're so used to thinking of as, like, we sort of have this sense that the vagina and female sexuality are imbued with shame no matter what, that there's something just plain shameful about this, or, you know, demeaning or slut-making, right? And yet you look at these other cultures, and they actually, before Judeo-Christianity, specifically St. Paul and the Church Fathers, even our earliest human civilizations, like in Sumer and Babylon, worshipped the vagina. There were, you know, goddesses who were very powerful, if not more powerful in the pantheon than gods, and they were specifically, at least one of them, like Inanna, was a sex goddess, if you like, and at that time the vagina was seen as the gateway between this dimension and the next. It was seen, Inanna, there are wonderful documents from Sumer where she talks about, you know, the universe's wisdom as connected to her beautiful vagina, as she describes it. And again, in Tantra, so different. The vagina is seen as sacred. The yoni is considered a sacred space. And if you look at the language of Taoist poets, it's so poetic compared to the very ugly and vulgar language around the vagina in Western culture, going back now for centuries. Poets in the Taoist tradition would talk about the jade gate, the golden lotus, you know, the peony blossom. So these are, yeah, these are very dramatic differences.
Now, you point out that one of the problems that of the vagina in general that prompted you to write the book was low sexual desire in women.
Well, you know, again, I would flip it around a little bit. I thought I knew a lot about female sexuality. I've always been interested in it and always read, you know, the latest news. But it turns out that our understanding of what female arousal and desire and pleasure are is wrong in this culture, because it's based on science that's 40 years out of date. It kind of got stuck with Masters and Johnson. And so the result of that, I would say, is just what you described. Because of our ignorance about these really important discoveries in the last 40 years and our misconception of what women need, which is pretty much the same as what men need, right? Because that's what Masters and Johnson concluded, that men and women are similar. There's arousal, plateau, climax, resolution. In fact, the latest science shows they're very, very different. But because of this misunderstanding and other misunderstandings that I report on, the data for women's sexual happiness in our culture is quite low. Shockingly low, like 40 years after the quote-unquote sexual revolution, 30% of women still don't reach orgasm when they want to and define it in their terms as a problem. Mm-hmm. And another 30%, as you mentioned, and this was a really shocking number, but many studies confirm it, and some actually go higher. And these are some of the same women and some different women report low libido. They're not into it. It's not working for them. They've switched off. And they say that that's a problem for them as they define it. So, you know, those numbers haven't budged since Sheer Height wrote the Height Report in 1976. So obviously there's something about the sexual revolution that isn't working as well as it should for women. And now I know what it is. It's these misunderstandings that I report on, the ignorance about the new anatomy and literally the construction of female response, sexual response.
Now, one of the points you make in the book is that the feminist models of female sexuality are untenable also. And I wonder what impact that might have on women's sexual desire. I mean, if you say things like a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle, that's not going to increase sexual desire.
Well, I want to be very careful here, Paul, because, you know, feminism has done many wonderful things for women's ownership of their sexual pleasure. But it is true that just like I critique the porn model of sex as not really being that helpful to women and also not helpful to men who are trying to learn about women, right? It doesn't give men good information about women. And I go into detail as to why that is. By the same token, a feminist model, which I would say is actually kind of a post-consumer model of, you know, what a woman should be, kind of completely negates attachment and intimacy and trust and all these other emotional aspects. You know, you're supposed to be able to just hook up and, you know, be very compartmentalized about your sex life or your sexual passion. That's the model we have in our culture. The trouble is that the latest neuroscience confirms that the female mind-body connection is so profound in sexuality. I'm sure the male mind-body connection is too. I just didn't happen to write that book. But one thing that's critical to understand is the role of the autonomic nervous system in female sexual response. So what is that? It doesn't sound very sexy. It's very sexy. The autonomic nervous system is the part of you that, if you're a woman and getting aroused, boosts your heart rate, sends blood coursing through your body, makes your skin more sensitive, raises your respiration, you know, sends blood to engorge your inner and outer labia, goes to lubrication, you know, makes the clitoris erect, and so on. And it's very, 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 obviously very important. But the thing that stops that process right in its tracks is stress. And it can be emotional stress, it can be fear, it can be resentment, it can be distrust. So this is a huge insight confirming what women know intuitively, right? But so many readers have said, oh, Naomi, you've like shown me, you've given me backup. Like women are saying they're chasing their husbands and lovers around the house saying, see, you know, I knew this was true and this confirms it scientifically. It means that if you snap at a woman at 7 o'clock in the morning, or, you know, if her issue is you don't put the socks in the hamper, you drop them next to the hamper, and that makes her feel disrespected. And then you want to make love to her at 7 o'clock at night, and she can't just switch on. She's not a bitch. She's not withholding. She's not crazy. Her body literally can't make that transition. And putting it more positively, and again, this is, it gets a round of applause and like standing ovations when I say it to audiences, from women, if you want a woman enthusiastically to want to make love to you for the rest of her life, you have to be nice to her for the rest of her life and partner with her in the things that stress her out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And seems you don't obvious. Think men know that?
Well, you know, I'm very happy if you and all the men that you know that.
All the men I know that.
I mean, that's wonderful. And if you post your phone numbers online with this interview, you will get lots of phone calls from women. Men, look, obviously men know that they have to be nice to women as an abstraction. And I know for sure, because half of my audiences are men, that overwhelmingly men want to know how to be nice to women. But I don't think they're fully aware, as I wasn't either, that there literally cannot be an arousal process unless whatever's stressing the woman out emotionally has been cleared up between them. For example, a woman wrote to me and said, I thought I was crazy. I have to have the house clean before I can make love with my husband. But now I know why I have to do that. Or, you know, it goes on and on, I thought I was crazy. In our culture, men are told to seduce women until they get them, but they're not taught that they have to keep seducing them forever.
Right, and they're not really taught anything.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's one of the big problems that you mentioned in the book, that men are not, you talk about porn addiction and basically say that men are more or less by default being trained by porn in terms of how they approach their lovemaking, as opposed to being trained in some better way. But I don't think there ever has been a way that men have been trained. I mean, how do you see it? I mean, what is the cause for men's ignorance?
Oh, that's a big, interesting, complicated question.
But it's pretty important.
It's so important.
Yeah.
So important. Well, let's just look at like some of the things. I just want to report on what men have told me, because I don't want to speak for them.
Yeah.
But often what they say is, I learned nothing about women that was valuable from locker room conversation, and I learned nothing that was valuable from porn. And one of the things that's happened with porn is that it is contracting the amount of time that's given to all of these kinds of seduction that I describe later on in the book. And so it's making, it's boosting time pressure on women. Now, paradoxically, the reason that tantric workshops that I report on have these off-the-charts results with women, and not just orgasm, but sexual healing and emotional healing and so on, is that the men are taught to do sacred spot massage, which is G-spot massage, for an hour and a half without asking for anything in return. And so this is so radical in a culture where women are expected to be constantly thinking, is he getting bored? Is he losing interest? Am I pretty enough? Do I compare with this porn star? Whatever. That dials down the stress on women, and it lets that magical autonomic nervous system response take over. But the average man reaches orgasm in 4 minutes. The average woman takes 16 minutes to reach orgasm. And if porn is making that attention span, you know, that sexual attention span shorter and shorter and shorter, that goes to the 30% of women who are not reaching orgasm, you know, when they want to. So part of it is time, and part of it is that we don't even know these things. Let me give you another example of what's not reported. We still think of the G-spot and the clitoris, right, in our culture. But anatomists have found a new neural structure, the anterior wall of the female pelvis, such that the north of it is the G-spot and the south of it, I beg your pardon, the north of it is the clitoris and the south of it is the G-spot. And 90% of women reach orgasm in lab conditions with strangers when both of these points are stimulated at the same time, which is big. Like, to me, as a reporter, this is big news. It's like if some scientist stumbled on a new sex organ on the male body, it would be Nobel Prize work. It would be front page news in the New York Times. But I didn't even know about this. And women don't know about this. Men don't know about this. This study came out in an academic journal, completely unreported. There's so much censorship of female, just the anatomy and desire in our culture. A poster for Eve Ensler's vagina monologues got taken down yesterday in like some town in America. And, you know, my book got, the title got asterisked out by iTunes.
And do you think that's because of the word vagina?
I do. I think it's because this all goes back to the dopamine. I think that our culture is so freaked out by women actually owning their bodies and owning their sexuality and their right to pleasure without shame and self-hatred, because they would not, you know, all hell would break loose. You just couldn't control
women
the same way.
I don't see that, but maybe I live in a liberal pocket.
You do live
in a
liberal
pocket. I don't see that at all. Mm-hmm. I see no evidence of that in my life. But
why do you think, you know, iTunes didn't asterisk out penis in the titles that had penis? You know, why is, you know, there were debates in the Michigan State House, like this last election cycle.
I don't think very many people use the word penis. I don't even think very many people use the word penis at all.
Well,
I think there's quite a bit of shame around male sexuality.
You're
too.
Probably right.
Pudendum is a masculine word.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So there's been shame for a long time.
That's
and I,
true.
You know, I would attribute it to a lot of factors, certainly patriarchy, religion, etc.
Yeah.
But, you know, you make a very interesting relationship between female orgasm and creativity, which I alluded to in the introduction, and I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Can you speak to that?
Sure. And it's interesting that, you know, this book has been very, very controversial with critics, not with readers who adore it. I mean, as I said, you know, half my audiences are men, and overwhelmingly a huge number of readers buy it for their grown children, their sons and daughters, which is very, very interesting. But one of the reasons it's been controversial is that I do make that connection about creativity and this brain science. So it was partly from looking at, you know, the hormones and neurotransmitters that I described, but also from interviewing women about their experience of the brain-vagina connection. And when I asked them questions about this, I got the most extraordinary responses. Also, I'd looked at many biographies, as you mentioned, of great women, especially in the 19th and early 20th century, and there was, once I knew what to look for, these very consistent periods of creative expansiveness after a sexual awakening. And it didn't have to be at the hands of a man. It could be at the hands of a woman or by herself. You know, you don't have to be in a relationship to have a sexual awakening. But, you know, I mean, Edith Wharton wrote some of the most daring work in her life during this passionate affair with Morton Fullerton in 1908 to 1910 that completely awakened her. You know, she became like in an erotic haze, and she was pushing every boundary in her work. And the same thing with Georgia O'Keeffe, who broke out of figurative painting, you know, with her affair with Alfred Stieglitz. And Alice B. Toklas, you know, in the wake of that relationship, Gertrude Stein created modernism, basically. She liberated herself from the structure, the syntactical structure of the English sentence. And if you think about what does dopamine do, it makes you take risks. You know, cocaine is dopaminic. So I asked women about this possible link, and I got these amazing stories. This actress blushed when I mentioned this connection. She said, "Oh my God, you've read my mind, you've read my diaries." Of course I hadn't. She said that sometimes when she is really transported creatively on stage, she will have an orgasm from the heightened sensibility,
that.
A creative sensibility. And other women, there's this fascinating thing called a vaginal pulse, which women can become aware of if they're asked to notice it, and which scientists actually measure with something called a vaginal pulsometer. But when I asked women to tell me, to report back to me when they noticed their vaginal pulse escalate, it wasn't always in erotic circumstances. Often it was in aesthetic circumstances, like the fog drifting over a mountain range, or when they were creating, when they were painting, when they were writing, interestingly, when they were in competitive situations sometimes. But the brain-vagina connection and its role in creativity and consciousness is, you know, was confirmed by multiple sources. And then flipping it around, the darker side of this connection is, you know, why is there infibulation? Why is there clitoridectomy? When you understand the science, you get why. And I've had doctors who work with, like, Doctors Without Borders in the Congo, confirmed to me what I witnessed myself in Sierra Leone, interviewing women who had been horribly, generally traumatized.
Right.
You know, they're like, duh, obviously, in retrospect, of course it's about dopaminic suppression. Of course, if you traumatize the vagina in this way, you traumatize the brain. And that's the goal of this systematic rape or systematic, you know, violent, sadistic, generally traumatizing rape or these practices that have been used for centuries in many parts of Africa.
I want to talk about monogamy. We're almost running out of time.
Oh, gosh.
You identify yourself as monogamous, but I'm wondering, how does monogamy support the needs of the vagina? I mean, you do mention Christopher Ryan's book, Sex at Dawn, in which the authors make an update of evolutionary biology that makes the case that we have not been a monogamous species for 99.9% of our existence. So how is monogamy serving the vagina?
I mean, I try not to be prescriptive in this book. The only section of the book that tells anyone what I think they should do is this section that maps up the best of tantric practices against Western science and encourages men to do things like, or people who love women, male or female, to,
right.
to use those things because they work and they make women happy. So I'm not going to say that monogamy or promiscuity serve the vagina. Obviously, if all you're looking for is a lot of orgasms, you know, promiscuity would probably serve the vagina better. But
well, polyamory and promiscuity are two different words. But
yeah, but I think, like, the message of my book, finally, you know, as Jim Faust, this wonderful neuroscientist in Montreal, said, we're wired for connection. So for me, the message is not that the vagina is misunderstood as merely flesh or just about pleasure. We're wired for connection, and really this book and understanding what makes women happy sexually, understanding the brain vagina connection, it's about love. It's about the transformational power of you know, eros and love and human connection, human contact, human caring.
So you're a firm believer in monogamy is the way to go.
You're pushing me in a direction I don't want to go. It works for me. Uh-huh. I believe in it. I was raised by in an.
But some people would say that it's the cause of lessening sexual desire, or one of the many causes.
I mean, certainly men and women both, their brains respond to novelty sexually, and that's why I think these tantric practices and other practices that I report on are so important for long-term relationships, because when you're dialing down the novelty, you have to dial up the oxytocin and other ways of really exciting and thrilling and, you know, stimulating the brain of your partner, basically, over time, because familiarity habituates men and women in a way that dulls eros, and other things boost eros, but I wouldn't say that. I mean, look at, it's not just about novelty. It's not just about who can, you know, step in. What makes people happy? Okay, one of the things that I take from Tantra is holding, right? We are not a culture that tells people if you're unhappy, you're depressed, you're dissatisfied, go get held. Right? The answer is not in something you buy. It's in yourself and someone near you. But men's sweat actually has a sedative anti-stress effect on heterosexual women's brains, and it regulates their menstrual cycle. It lowers their heart rate. So just knowing that you need to hold your wife or your girlfriend for 10 minutes on a Sunday morning after a stressful week in bed, or take her slow dancing, hold her, put your arm around her so that she can smell you.
And don't take a shower before your date. No.
Well, you're taking it to that point, but you know, you're not wrong, as it turns out, probably technically, but anyway, the point is her subconscious mind is having a powerful response to the animality of the male body, and we are animals as well as, you know, having spirits and having hearts, and so is that about her, you know, her orgasm? No. Does it make her like you more and want to share with you and feel close to you and make her life feel more meaningful? Absolutely.
Right.
And again, if she's not in a relationship, there are things you can do to look after yourself and love yourself and feel, you know, meet your own sensual needs that are very important as well.
You know, it's just too bad this show is so short. I'm looking at the clock, and we are out of time here. And we could go on for a long time.
Thank
this
you.
Is a fascinating subject.
Thank
it's
you.
A fascinating book.
Thank
you for writing it. Thank you for being on the show. One last thing. Tell us about your website.
Well,
or the one related to the book.
Sure. There's info@naomiwolf.org where you can write to me. And
okay.
You can share your story if you want. And there's naomiwolf.org, which is my website, and you can always talk to me on Facebook.
Right. Okay. naomiwolf.org. And once again, we've run out of time. Thank you so much, Naomi, for being on Pathways. It's been a pleasure. And for those who tuned in late, this is Paul O'Brien, and you can replay this entire interview anytime you want via the internet at divination.com or kboo.fm. Today we have been visiting with Naomi Wolf, author of the new book, The Vagina. To our listeners, I want to say thank you for tuning in to Pathways, which is made possible in part by a grant from the Divination Foundation. Information at divination.com. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com. This is your host, Paul O'Brien, reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways and its podcast, the interview program dedicated to personal and cultural transformation. Thanks again for tuning in and being a part of it. Thank you.